You're listening to the Faith Unpacked podcast.
Welcome back to the Faith Unpacked podcast with Jason and Jamie. This is episode 167. And today, Jason is finally back with us after having conquered the world or been gone. I guess we haven't really told you so much about what that was or whatnot. So Jason, welcome back. Thanks for coming back. And what have you been up to for the last couple of weeks?
Yeah, glad to be back in one piece. And it is very good to be back in the States. I will say that the trip that I went on was very, very enjoyable, but also very exhausting. So Whitney, my wife and I, and my parents and a group of about 40 of us went to on a tour of some biblical lands. And the tour was called In the Footsteps of Paul and the Churches of Revelation. So we basically went to a lot of these locations mentioned in the Bible, learned some of the archaeological discoveries that have been going on there, learned about some of the background of the culture, and just, you know, walked where the apostles walked. So it was a lot of fun. Definitely recommend it.
So Jason, on a trip like that, what were your kind of takeaways? I know you saw a lot of sites there, were able to even do some teaching in various places, help connect scripture with locations and kind of help cement the word of God in people's minds. But what did the Lord teach you and your wife on this trip?
Yeah, I mean, so much. It's hard to pinpoint one thing, but I'll say that one of the coolest aspects I'd say is just being able to stand in some of these locations like Ephesus or Corinth or Athens, you know, these places that you and I, we've read about in our Bibles and we've been able to kind of imagine it, right? But when you're able to actually stand there and see what they saw, in a sense, obviously the buildings have changed, they've deteriorated, and some of the buildings aren't even standing anymore, things like that. But I think it's just helpful to kind of get a grasp of, okay, how big is Ephesus, this city that Paul visited? What was that ministry like in this massive, sprawling city? Or for instance, like in Corinth, you know, just to be there and see the temple of Aphrodite overlooking the city of Corinth, it was really, it's insightful because there's times when you read through 1st and 2nd Corinthians where Paul will be alluding to something, and I'm not going to say you don't understand it just by reading the Bible. Obviously, if you have your Bible and your English translation, you can get the message of the Bible. You don't actually have to go to these locations. It's good to clarify that. But I will say it adds a dimension to your reading when you can read the passage, like 1 Corinthians 6, for example. It talks about Paul warning about sexual immorality, warning about not joining yourself to a prostitute. And you might think, yeah, well, that's very clear that that would be a bad thing to do, and that's sexual immorality. But when you see that this temple overlooking the city had temple prostitutes, and you learn that as they came down, those it's a very steep hill. They came down this hill, and they identified themselves in different ways. Some of them, they wore sandals where they left footprints that said, "Follow me," in the sand. And others had shaved head. If you had a shaved head, that was an indication that you were a temple prostitute. And so basically the Corinthians turned sex into an act of worship, sex with prostitutes into an act of worship. And when you can go to these locations and see, okay, this is what Corinth was dealing with. I mean, this is the city that Paul went to. This is where he planted a church. And looming above all of this is this massive wall and this structure on top of the wall that's saying, this is all about sex. This is all about come up here and worship the gods with us. It just kind of gives you a better appreciation of what Paul was up against and really how fearless he was, how courageous to speak truth in a corrupt society like that. And to think of the influence that he's had over 2,000 years, where so many of these things that are, well, up until maybe more recently, have been considered wrong because they go against God's design. That was back then, it was considered normal. People worshiped, like I said, in this very immoral way, and it was part of their lifestyle, part of their culture. And Paul came in with a message of, hey, it's time to abandon all that, give up all that way of worship because it's a false god, and come worship the one true God, live in purity. So I appreciated that. I appreciate that aspect of seeing the landscape and seeing different features that you don't necessarily jump out to in the same way when you're just reading the text.
Yeah, that's a good point. That I'm sure would have been a lot of fun to follow through and really see, you know, where Paul was and what Paul was dealing with in all these different places. But it does really underscore the fact that while time changes, the human heart does not, right? Mm-hmm. In that the same things you're talking about, I would say, are very much alive and well in our culture today as well, where we don't call the gods by the same names, but we still worship them as a culture, as a people, and we even worship them in the same way. You know, you get into those conversations with people where they're like, well, we don't commit sex as an act of worship, but we very much do. You know, we don't do baby sacrifice. Well, actually, we still do. You know, we just call them all by different names. So it is funny that while things change, they really don't.
It's totally true. Well, and something else that you just can't help notice is when you go to these ruins, there are gods everywhere, like statues, altars, shrines. You know, they're still there. They're in the rocks. They're evidence that these people were very religious. You know, it talks about in Acts 17 when Paul went to Athens. One of his observations was that people were very religious in the city, and yet it was known as the cultural center of the world, so to speak. Athens was seen as, you know, this is the apex of cultural sophistication, and yet they were very religious. And what's interesting is that today people are more reticent to admit that they're religious and admit that they're serving a god, as you're talking about. They go by other names, but back then it was kind of just more of a, this is our way of viewing the world. This is a total worldview, that there's this pantheon of gods and this is how we worship. And, you know, they were very upfront about this is a religion. Today, people mask that, and people don't want to admit to being involved in a religion, and would rather say something in a more individualistic sense, like, I'm just being true to myself. I'm following my truth. I'm just being me, things like that, expressing my individuality. All of that really boils down to the same, as you said, same fleshly desires of the heart. That's going to show up throughout human history. But that's something that you just can't help but notice, is that people were really openly religious before Christ and the gospel was brought to these countries.
Yeah, that is an interesting point, which, you know, in some ways you think, well, that actually creates, you know, greater opportunity to share the gospel, because when people are, you know, we've talked about this in terms of apologetics before, it's so much easier to have a gospel conversation with somebody who's quote unquote religious or a member of another religion than it is somebody who, you know, is an atheist or agnostic or indifferent, you know, that sort of thing. But I am curious, did you notice, as you're going along from place to place, you're obviously in different areas and more or less different cultures and all these sort of things, but did you still see a lot of commonalities between it?
Yeah. So we were primarily in Western Turkey and Greece and Italy, Germany also, but that wasn't really connected to any biblical lands, obviously. But yeah, I mean, aside from just the fact that, you know, the cultures all were very religious, architecture in many ways was similar. There's columns and arches and something just, you know, maybe as a corrective to what people often envision and people thinking, well, you know, primitive people or people of the ancient past, they weren't as, you know, evolved or as sophisticated as us. I think that's an assumption that's often made. But these people were architectural geniuses, frankly. When you look at what they accomplished and how, I mean, it's still standing. That says something. So much of what they built is still standing because of the architectural integrity and just like the beauty and design of so many of these structures and pillars and all. It's like they combined art with ingenuity, with durability in a way that you don't see as often in modern architecture. And granted, you know, they were working with what they had, and we have more advanced technology for using certain things. We don't use stone, for instance, quite as much. But the fact that they did what they did and that so much of it can still be seen, that jumped out to me. That's pretty astounding. And it's a way for God, kind of bringing this to a biblical application. It's a way for God to preserve the lands where the gospel first came for us. I mean, if you just think about it, if these structures were all built with wood, they wouldn't be standing. Because they were built with stone, and so much of what these locations that are talked about in the Bible, I mean, take the Colosseum, for example, that was built in the first century. And yeah, you know, a good portion of it has crumbled and it's not everything it was. But the fact that so much of it is standing and that so much has happened to it, I mean, we're talking about there's been invasions, there's been bombs going off, and it's still there. Like, that's pretty incredible. And you wouldn't have that had they not used so much stone and marble and all the things that you just don't see as often in our architecture. But it's a way for God to, I think, in his providence, it's amazing how archaeology continues to confirm what the Bible has clearly said. And when we dig up and excavate these things, and they're still preserved in a sense, and things like the Pool of Siloam in Jerusalem that was found not too terribly long ago, I believe, and you know, it was exactly as described by the Gospel of John, you know, things like that. If it hadn't been built with stone, that wouldn't have been something we could go and dig up and be able to say, wow, the Bible was accurate about this too. So it's, I'd say it's faith reaffirming to see that and that was in God's plan.
Yeah. It kind of reminds me of, you know, you used to hear a few years ago that Pontius Pilate, you know, wasn't a real guy. That was just a mythical story in the Bible that wasn't backed by any evidence. I mean, there is record in Roman history of Pontius Pilate, but that was just seen as, you know, that just there to prove, you know, something, a biblical story that wasn't really true, and he wasn't actually a real guy, and there just wasn't a lot of historic evidence or historic proofs of his existence, right? And then just here a few years ago, they found an inscription to Pontius Pilate and had to concede, okay, yeah, he was a real guy. yeah, so pretty cool how that works out. Now, somebody was telling me at your church that the reason you guys went to Germany was for a special, like, passion play or something like that.
That's right. Yeah, in Oberammergau, Germany, which is, I don't know, maybe 60 or maybe more than that, 70 miles southwest of Munich, something like that. There is nestled up against the Alps, there is this little Bavarian village, I guess you'd call it. I mean, just a small town where it's a pretty awesome story, actually. It was, I wish I could remember the dates. I want to say this was at least 400 years ago. Somebody can Wikipedia this and test me on this, but a long time ago, there was a plague going on. I think it was the plague, in fact, that you typically think of, the bubonic plague. And the people of Oberammergau prayed and asked God that they would be spared. And they even said they committed to putting on a passion play every 10 years in gratitude to God preserving them. That was their commitment, if God would save them from the plague. God did save them from the plague, and they have done this passion play every 10 years, and it has just like exploded, obviously, over the last 100 years. It was started out very small, very, I'm sure, unimpressive. But today, I mean, this is a massive production. The costumes, I mean, literally guys ride out on horses, camels, onto this big old stage, and it just, it's very, very much a well-honed production. It's something to see, and it's no wonder that people come from all over the world to see this play. And it is only once every 10 years, but by that, I mean, it's only throughout the whole year. Basically, they have it, I think it's like maybe 6 months of actual time that they're putting on the play in a year, but it's that only happens once every 10 years. So this town really invests a lot into putting this on. And you, from what I understand, and I never looked this up to confirm it, but somebody told us that only locals were allowed to be cast members in this passion play. So you had to live in Oberammergau to be in this passion play that they've been doing every 10 years. So that alone just kind of, it's encouraging, like, to see this little town of people who are so committed to putting on the message of Christ and his suffering, his death, and his resurrection, all that. I mean, it's just something to see. And I will tell you, it's all in German. So if you're going there expecting to understand everything without first learning German, yeah, you're going to be disappointed. And I will tell you, I didn't understand it that well. I've only taken a little bit of German, but even if you know the whole story, I think it's nice that they give you a script in English, so you can follow along in the English, or you can just go back and read it later, which is what I plan to do. But there's so much emotion in the actors, and so much, like, you can just see they put it all out on the line there as far as their passion in performing in the play and things like that, that you know what's going on, even if you don't know all the words and don't know everything being said. So it was something to see. It was well done, and I would definitely recommend it, even if you don't speak German.
Well, it sounds a lot, you know, kind of like opera, where you hear songs in Latin or Italian or whatever it is that and the story is told through the emotion, through the action more than it is the words. And so you kind of get a sense for the storyline, even though, yeah, so that, especially when done well, that sounds pretty neat. Was that originally part of that regular tour every 10th year, or did they just tack that on since it was happening, and why not?
They tacked that on. The tour itself, the Footsteps of Paul and the Churches of Revelation, that's a tour they regularly do. This is a more of a one-off because of, yeah, only being every 10 years. And actually, it was supposed to be 2 years ago, which makes sense, 2020 being on coming on a 10th year, but because of COVID, it got delayed 2 years, and so the tour got delayed 2 years. But yeah, I should add that a good chunk of it was singing. So when you mentioned opera, yeah, it was very much like that because the singing was outstanding too. And again, you know, you don't know all the words unless you have like, unless you're reading along with the script, which they have that provided for you. But nonetheless, it's very impressive and very enjoyable.
That's awesome. That's cool. Well, hopefully you were also able. I know you mentioned that it was a lot and kind of stressful and a lot of work in some ways. But hopefully you got some restfulness out of it and just some takeaway thoughts coming back home. What encouragements did you take from all of this towards just regular life or pastoral ministry or where do you see things going forward here?
Yeah, I think it's always good, you know, to be thinking in that way. And my dad, who's also a pastor, you know, mentioned that even at the beginning, that he's going to be thinking of ways, how can I apply this to my preaching and my ministry and things like that. I think it's just good to have that mindset. Any time, obviously, any experiences, how can you use this? But I think just being able to, experience the locations, that's going to be beneficial for when I preach or teach on these subjects, these locations. It actually gets me, it got me more fired up about archaeology. I've already ordered a book on archaeology since getting back because, it's something, it's fascinating, right? I mean, it's hard to not be excited about that when you know these discoveries just keep pouring in. And literally, we were at some of these locations like Laodicea. They had archaeologists on site still excavating this big city of Laodicea. And that was happening all over. It wasn't just there. That just kind of makes you aware, wow, these things are, we're still learning more. We're still finding out more. I think that is something that all Christians, if you're going to go on a trip like this, expect that kind of thing, just a renewed desire to see the archaeological evidences and be able to talk about that. When you share the gospel with others, you know, it's good to have in your back pocket, so to speak, information about the Dead Sea Scrolls and why that helps confirm why we can trust the Bible we hold in our hands today, or why the gospel writers weren't just writing myths about Jesus, making things up about him. Well, everything else they said, Luke was an incredible historian. Everything that archaeologists have dug up and verified with other, you know, extra biblical writings has matched up with Luke, that skeptical historians have actually set out to disprove Luke and ended up rewriting their whole thesis because Luke convinced them otherwise. And I think things like that, it's just good for Christians to be aware of. And especially because in America, we live in an increasingly skeptical and increasingly secular world. It's good to know what are the historical roots, what are the verifiable proofs for what I believe. And it's not a matter of just, this is a nice story that makes me feel good. But this is something rooted in history. That's how Christianity has always been that way. The gospel has always been rooted in the historical death and resurrection of a historical man, Jesus of Nazareth. But again, if you only kind of have the flannel board depiction of Jesus in your mind, where everything's kind of just Jesus floating along above above everything and not really an earthly human, then it's hard to imagine. But you go to these places and you start to say, wow, this is what it looked like. This is how it can inspire me to talk about the gospel in my age and in my city, because just like, hey, Ephesus was a thriving city once, now it's a place where people go to see all these historic ruins. Well, the city you live in today might be thought of in that way someday, and yet you can make an impact for the gospel where you're at.
Yeah, it's a great point, Jason. I think it's so important. Like you said, living in an increasingly skeptical culture, it becomes paramount that we have something to say when somebody asks the question, why are you a believer? Or why should I believe that the Bible is true? You know, these are very legitimate questions. And something that I often say is, you know, reminding people that we are not, we are saved by faith, but we do not believe on faith. Meaning there is every bit of evidence to the truth that the Bible teaches, to the truth of God's word, to the truth that Jesus is who he says he is, that he did what he said he did, and that then the gospel that he proclaims through him can be true, and we can be reconciled to God, and we can live with God eternally. All of that is very much dependent on all this evidence. And so that's, yeah, that's awesome. Sounds like a great, sounds like a really great trip. A lot of good lessons, a lot of good information, and a new love for some aspects of that archaeology and all that. Why don't you go ahead and give our listeners a final word? What do you want to say in wrapping all of this up together for them?
Yeah, I'd say probably biggest thing is know that you don't need to go on these trips. And I don't want to make it sound like this is like a pilgrimage to Mecca where you're going to be closer to God after one of these trips. I want to be very clear about that. However, if you do get a chance to go on one of these trips and you don't get airsick flying and you're okay walking quite a bit, I think it's really beneficial. That's the way I'd put it, is look into it in the future, maybe save up some money here and there so that you can think about going to these locations, because you're going to come away thankful that you went. And for whatever that's worth, don't put it on a pedestal, but also see it as beneficial. I encourage you to do it. It's something I'm glad I got to do this time. And hopefully I will be able to do something like this, visiting maybe Israel or other places like that in the future.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith Unpacked podcast. We're so thankful for your time. We hope and pray that these encourage your faith and walk with Jesus Christ. If you'd like to hear past episodes, you can find them on our website at faithunpacked.com. We'd also invite you to subscribe on your favorite podcasting site. If you have any questions, feel free to hit us up on social media, or you can send us an email at faithunpacked@gmail.com. And we invite you back next time as we continue to unpack our faith together.